Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. From the Arts Desk at the Muncie Civic Theater, it's the best Christmas pageant ever through December 20th. You can see the full schedule and their gift-giving ideas at MuncieCivic.org. Muncie Symphony has Making Spirits Bright with the Key Trio at the Rose Court on December 20th. The Anderson Symphony Orchestra Christmas Concert is Saturday the 13th at the Paramount Theater. And the Marion Civic Theater has A Christmas Story based on the Gene Shepherd tales through the 14th. The price of gasoline has gone way down recently, and we'll see what effect that has on the use of bicycles for transportation. 16 million bicycles were sold in the U.S. last year, and more are being used for commuting. We thought about bikes recently with the release of a new book, The Fast Times of Albert Champion, by Peter Joffrey Nye, a biography of the legendary founder of AC Delco and Champion Spark Plug. Champion started as a bicycle racer, something of a jazz age celebrity and daredevil who came to this country from Paris to race bikes. Nye is a Ball State graduate from the 1970s who wrote much of the book at his family farmhouse in Fortville near Pendleton. In talking about his book, The History of Cycling, Indiana's Place in the Culture of Racing, and the Technology that Grew from Cycling, we got to talking about Frank DeFord, the NPR commentator.
I really enjoy Frank DeFord's commentary. What's he like as a person?
He's an original. He has a lot of experience, and he's really good at regaling. You know, he's a raconteur, basically. I mean, he's a journalist raconteur, and he loves people, and he loves personalities. And he's got a font of stories that make you laugh out loud. He's a very generous-hearted guy.
What was the project that you were on with him?
That was called 6-Day Bicycle Races. America's Jazz Age Sport is the subtitle. The documentary premiered at the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival. It premiered in 2006. And afterward was on the International Film Festival circuit. There are dozens of these film festivals all around North America, as far north as Alberta, Canada, and then over to London, Edinburgh, and Berlin.
What is it about the jazz age and bicycles? I'm thinking down in southern Indiana, In French Lick, I think they had a giant velodrome or West Baden Springs, one of those places.
They did, yes, but that was earlier in the century. And all of that was because of Frank Kramer. Frank Kramer was from Evansville, Indiana. And Frank Kramer was, in his time to bicycle racing, what Michael Jordan became in basketball or Tiger Woods. Frank Kramer was very much in demand. He got $10,000 as an appearance fee to go to Paris, for example. That was straight appearance money in 1910. That was a lot of money. And that was strictly appearance money. He was winning $1,500 or $1,500 per race. And he was racing two or three times a week.
And this is what your documentary was about.
Well, the documentary was about the 6-day bicycle races, which had a phenomenal hold as an entertainment here in America. These were indoor events. So that there were 75 of them alone over a half century in Madison Square Garden. They were held in most every city in the United States that today supports professional baseball teams.
It's reminding me of the gang that couldn't shoot straight. Remember?
That's right.
That was
Yeah. Jimmy Breslin's novel.
Which featured a bicycle or an attempt to organize a bicycle race. But so right. Bicycle racing was super popular at that time. I guess we've kind of forgotten about that.
Well, the whole sports spectrum in America changed after World War II, and then with the introduction of television, that changed everything. It's hard to believe that, for example, in the biography I write on Albert Champion, he probably was the very first foreign athlete to be recruited to come and compete in the United States. He was hired from his home in Paris, expenses paid across the Atlantic in a ship, and with a salary to compete for a Boston bicycle manufacturer to compete for the 1900 season. But back then, you know, the early 20th century, football was a raffish underworld sport. boxing was more or less in the red light district, and basketball was only starting to migrate from the northeast west to the Midwest and down south. Basketball had only been around for 10 years.
So people were really into bicycle racing.
They were into bicycle racing as entertainment, along with watching horse races, along with watching also live entertainment. This is before radio and television. So live entertainment, whether it was athletes competing like bicycle racers or watching horse races or baseball games, or going to cabarets or nightclubs to see bands.
This book, The Fast Times of Albert Champion, this is about a Parisian bicycle racer who comes to the United States to compete and then ends up founding one of the signature auto parts makers in America.
Yeah, you're right, and I'm glad you bring that up, because he was a big star as a bicycle racer on the continent in Europe. And he was such a big star that he was recruited to come to the United States for a manufacturer in Boston, making bicycles. He was recruited to come to race in America for the 1900 season. So he arrived in November 1899. And bear in mind that it's easy to overlook today that when bicycles were new, they were new technology like typewriters, elevators, telephones. And they had immediate application for people. Now, bicycles really represent the very first time in history, and it took me a little while to get comfortable putting my mind around it, but this is the first time in history that if people wanted to go somewhere, they no longer had to hitch or saddle a horse. In the late 19th century, bicycles were like breakthrough technology.
They were somewhat controversial at first, right? Outlawed in some, or really restricted in some areas out of concern that it would spook the horses and things like that.
Well, America in 1900, according to the U.S. Census, had 18 million horses and mules. There were 10 million bicycles. And do you want to guess how many cars there were in the United States for the 1900 census?
In 1900, 1,000, 10,000? Am I close?
Yeah, you're right. There were only about 10,000. In fact, there were so few, and it was such a relatively recent industry, that the U.S. Census lumped automobiles in with miscellaneous. Now, in two decades, say between 1900 and 1910, automobiles started to really take off. But in a way, like today, people of a certain age may recall how offices went from having typewriters to computers. And in the 80s and 90s, offices changed completely. Between 1900 and 1920, we had the rise of automobiles in the United States. So that by 1920, the automobile industry was the largest in the country. And with the growth of the automobile industry came growth in the steel industry, came growth in the rubber industry, and where would Texas be without cars to consume all that oil? It was an enormous transformation in society, the economy, and technology.
Peter Joffrey Nye, writer of The Fast Times of Albert Champion, about the founder of AC Delco and Champion Spark Plug. As Frank DeFord wrote in a back cover blurb for the book, Champion may be largely forgotten, but he seems to have been everywhere at a time when the world found new ways of fast transportation, and then he became one of the most successful entrepreneurs of the wild new automobile industry.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com.
Why did they have the high wheel bicycles? They're fascinating to look at, but right. What was the thinking?
That was the prototype. And you raised the issue of the velocipede, and the velocipede was created in France, in Paris. That was in the 1860s. And it was new then, 1860s, new.
What was it exactly? I mean, I know the term, I just thought it meant it.
Well, vélo in French is wheel. So it was a two-wheel contraption. The wheels were made out of cast iron. The whole thing weighed more than 100 pounds. So it was very difficult in hills, especially pedaling uphill. Also, the ride was very stiff because you're talking about cast iron. You're talking about wooden wheels with an iron rim. But in 1890, we had introduction of the modern bicycle, as I mentioned. And then right around that time came, you know, John Boyd Dunlop invented a pneumatic tire. Now, the pneumatic tire created a great deal of suspicion because the consumers at that time thought, you think you're going to sell me something that's filled with what? Air? And so pneumatic tires, which we take for granted today, were a very hard sell because they were competing against the traditional hard rubber tire, which we have today on grocery cart wheels.
Was there someone, the Henry Ford, if you will, of bicycles who helped really popularize the what we have today?
Well, here in the United States, yeah, there was Albert Pope was the big innovator, and he introduced a bicycle that he called the Columbia, which is a name, a brand still around.
Were there technological advances with that? Or
right. Pope founded his business in the late 1870s. And by 1900, there were more than 300 bicycle manufacturers in the United States. And amazingly, many of them went on to make bicycles. For example, a big car that's iconic of the 1920s would be the Pierce Arrow. And George Pierce in Buffalo, New York, was making bicycles in the 1880s and 1890s. And he advertised his bicycles with an arrow with a flint head. And so you had the name Pierce that with an arrow going through the middle of it. So when he converted his factory operation to make cars, they were called Pierce Arrow.
I'm thinking the two best-known bicycle makers have to be the Wright brothers. You know, had they not invented the plane, would we remember what they did in bicycles?
You raise a really good point, because when I was thinking about embarking on writing this biography on Albert Champion, I thought it was kind of quaint myself, speaking candidly. I thought it was quaint that the Wright brothers had first had a bicycle shop in Dayton, Ohio. I thought, what an interesting coincidence. But it turns out that a great many people in early aviation also came from bicycles. For a while, the Wright brothers were very protective of their planes, and they didn't do anything. And Glenn Curtis in Buffalo, New York, who was a professional bicycle racer for Pierce Bicycles, also created a plane. It was basically a technology series of developments, just like we have today, or we have seen recently with computers. One technology advancement creates two more technology advancements, which create four more technology advancements, and so it was also with a bicycle. You had the high wheel bicycle of the late 1870s into the 1880s, and then people in England, in Coventry, England, figured out, well, we can have both wheels the same size, and we can have the diamond frame, and we can have the chain drive. And then John Boyd Dunlop came up with, well, they need a softer ride, let's face it, because roads then were cobbles if they were paved. So Dunlop got a patent for his pneumatic tire. So, and then with that advent of the pneumatic tire on top of the bicycle with a chain drive, then in the 1890s, we had a real serious transportation advancement. Women could ride these, and that created enormous demand. The bicycles were so popular in the 1890s, I interviewed a man who collected sheet music, which was popular before radio and television, so that people, middle-class households, could afford pianos, and they needed sheet music for the new songs. And there were more than 150 songs written in the 1880s and 1890s just for the bicycle. We remember today Daisy Daisy.
A bicycle built for two. Yeah.
Right. That's just one example.
In its day, the bicycle was the cutting-edge technology, all kinds of advancements. And
right. And bear in mind that the bicycle created a demand which had never existed for affordable, personal, individual transportation. So when you get through the 1890s, when bicycling was a craze, especially in cities with parks, they were extremely popular, especially on weekends also when people could have time and Sunday riding in the park on their bicycles. But, you know, by 1900, 1901, 1902, people were getting tired of bicycles. People wanted something else, and that something else, as we know, were motor cars.
Peter Joffrey Nye, writer of The Fast Times of Albert Champion, about the founder of AC Delco and Champion Spark Plug, record-setting bicyclist, daredevil race car driver, early automobile innovator, and celebrity of the jazz age. Indiana has a few lines in the history of racing, and if you think of Breaking Away, the Little 500, the Hilly 100, the Rain Ride Across Indiana, we have some cycling chops too.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
Biographies can be unpredictable, exposing the lives of great leaders, the tawdry side of celebrities, the lions of business and industry. Then there's the category of biography about the person you never heard of or thought much about. Albert Champion is that kind of subject. You may have heard of Champion Spark Plugs or AC Delco, named for his initials AC, but you probably were not waiting for a book about him. That's all right. Peter Joffrey Nye, a Ball State journalism graduate, wrote one anyway. Working from his family farmhouse in Fortville, Nye has produced a look back at the jazz age of the 1920s and one of its most compelling characters. Champion grew up poor in France, came to the U.S. to race bicycles, became a racing daredevil, then a huge business success, whose reach included Indiana.
In early September 1908, the biggest selling car in the United States was the Buick, made in Flint, Michigan. And the owner of the Buick Motor Company was William Durant. And Durant had a dealership in Boston, and Albert went to the dealership with some of his spark plug samples. Reed was stamped with Champion, stamped on the porcelain. And Albert wanted to sell Durant an order of his Champion spark plugs. Durant recalls in an unpublished memoir that he looked upon those samples and told Champion, "These don't fit my Buick overhead engine, but the way you have made these shows quality. And if you can make something this good, even though I can't use it, I am sure that you can make spark plugs for me." And then Durant said, "I have this company in Flint, Michigan, and I'd like you to come and work for me." Now, Flint at that time was a real backwater town. Boston was very cosmopolitan and in some ways resembled Paris, where Albert was from. The idea of being invited to leave Boston to go to Flint, Michigan to work in a very small industry at that point, we're talking 1908, and this is early September 1908, must have taken a huge leap of faith. That meeting between Durant and Champion must have generated a lot of electricity. Each person Durant and Champion saw in one another that he needed the other. Durant needed Champion to make the spark plugs, which had to be created from scratch. And Champion wanted to be part of Durant's outfit because Durant was making then the largest number of cars in the United States, Buicks. So Champion left Boston, he walked out on his partners, and he moved to Flint. The records show he, Champion, arrived September 10, 1908, in Flint. The reason this is important is that Durant never told him what Durant's plans were, because on September 16, Durant incorporated General Motors as a holding company in New Jersey and quickly bought Cadillac Motor Company, Oldsmobile Motor Company, and some other companies.
And already had Buick.
Yeah, they were all added to Buick, right. So Albert was starting from scratch with a dozen Frenchmen whom he brought with him from Boston to Flint. And he made the spark plugs. The Buick engineers put them through a strict test, and they decided, these are excellent. We're going to go with these.
Was this spark plug somehow technologically advanced? I mean, a spark plug is, we don't normally see spark plugs. It's deep within the engine, you know, or on exterior.
Right.
So was it about these?
Well, these were made with porcelain because the porcelain could withstand high heat.
So what happened? Let's fast forward to the time when Champion.
One thing I really relished working on his biography was his restlessness. As Alfred P. Sloan said, that what made Albert Champion a great manufacturer, and Albert Champion by the 1920s was employing 3,500 workers at the plant in Flint, Michigan, and several hundred more at other plants he owned in Birmingham, England, and also Paris, France. Alfred P. Sloan said that what the key to Albert Champion's success was his restlessness. He was never pleased with what he was doing. Albert Champion went into, also expanded to, supplying spark plugs for race cars, which ran at high heats. And in the 1920s, we had the outdoor board car racing tracks, and the races were longer. In the first decade of the 20th century, car races were really short, like 5 miles or 1 mile, because cars were crapping out. They were breaking down. But by 1920, we had the outdoor board car racing tracks, which were 2 miles around. And the races were up to 250 miles long. The engines were bigger. They created more heat, so the spark plugs had to be more durable. And this helped Albert to get into the aviation industry. Albert Champion made a majority of the spark plugs used in World War I for planes. The racetracks for car racing were his proving grounds, so that into the 1920s, he was supplying airplanes to aviators, including Charles Lindbergh. Albert Champion had figured out that the Spirit of St. Louis would require about 33 hours in the air at an average speed of 115 miles an hour. He did the math and figured out that Lindbergh's plane needed to fire 28,944,000 sparks. Each spark had to be perfect. And to fly across the Atlantic in that solo flight. And his company made the spark plugs for Lindbergh.
Charles Lindbergh's flight was May 1927. 5 months later, Champion was back in Paris on business for General Motors. There was a fight with his second wife's boyfriend, and Champion was killed at age 49. Today, not so well remembered, but in his day, a daredevil celebrity of the jazz age. And the name has an enduring life on car parts. The book is The Fast Times of Albert Champion by Peter Joffrey Nye. And that, friends, is our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Dillman's Furniture of Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from Flex Steel, Bassett, and Simmons Beauty Rest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.